Renee and George emigrate with their dog after the war. Return to their hotel suite and they unlock the door. Easily losing their evening clothes, they dance by the light of the moon. To the penguins, the moon glows, the Oreos, the five saddens, the deep forbidden music they've been longing for. Renee and George Edward greet with their dog after the war. Renee and George Ed Magritte with their dog after the war. Were strolling down Christopher Street when they stopped in a men's store. With all of the mannequins dressed in the style that brought tears to their immigrant eyes. Just like the penguins, the moon glows, the Oreos, the five saddens, the easy stream of laughter flowing through the air. Renee and George and Magritte with their dog à près la guerre.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. This afternoon, we're going to talk about American popular singing groups from the 1940s to the present. That's why we began this afternoon with Paul Simon and his tribute to American popular music of the era. As time allows, this afternoon, we'll also play some music from the last 66 years. Our guest this afternoon in this portion of the program is Jay Warner. He is a six-time Grammy Award-winning music publisher. He's also a music historian and the author of a number of books, including American Singing Groups, A History from 1940 to Today. The book is an encyclopedia of American vocal music, focusing on the harmonies of pop, R&B, doo-wop, gospel, jazz, rock and roll, and soul. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments this afternoon for our guests. Maybe you have a story to share about the music we're going to talk about this afternoon. We look forward to hearing from you. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Jay Warner's book, American Singing Groups, A History from 1940 to Today, is published by Hal Leonard. The book was first published in 1992 as the Billboard Book of American Singing Groups. It's been updated now, and the updated version published in 2006, the title American Singing Groups, A History from 1940 to Today. Jay Warner, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
It's my pleasure.
You are obviously a great fan of vocal groups, and it all began as a young man coming of age in the 1960s in New York. Who were your favorites?
Oh, I grew up with a cross-section of acts from the Flamingos and the Moonglows to local groups like the Mystics and the Capris and Little Anthony and the Imperials. And then I got into the deeper hardcore stuff of the founding fathers like the Ravens and the Orioles. And I mean, it was just a cross-section. If there was harmony, I was interested. Jay and the Americans, Sha-na-na even when they were on key. I just swallowed up vocal groups. I mean, I loved all kinds of music, but I particularly collected vocal groups. I just wanted to make a comment since you opened the show with the Paul Simon song.
Uh-huh.
As a tribute to vocal groups. I don't know if you know, and it's kind of deep in Paul's background in history, but when he started as a songwriter and was relatively unknown, he used to do backup singing on a lot of different records, and there was a local Brooklyn group called the Mystics that had a chart record called All Through the Night, and it was Paul Simon singing harmony on the record.
That's great. What a wonderful story. There are so many wonderful stories in this book. It's an encyclopedia between two covers. Quite an undertaking. What inspired you to take on this project? And tell us about the research that you did for the book.
Well, the book, first of all, I look at it more as an entertaining reference than an encyclopedia. When you say encyclopedia to people, you scare them off. They have visions of 26 volumes that will collect dust.
Fair enough.
You
Good
know, this
point.
Is really, as it's been reviewed over the years, and I'm proud of the fact that it is really a thorough, entertaining reference that people can either pick up on certain decades and go to different groups alphabetically, or they can go into it for a specific act or just read it through. I've heard people call me about that they missed dates that they were going out on because they were reading it cover to cover for till 3 in the morning. So I'm very proud of the fact that I tried to write something that wasn't stuffy, that had an entertaining value. As far as how it came about, I was a avid record collector in New York, and I was collecting, as I said, most of the time, vocal group records. And I found that there was very little information about these acts. And as I got into the music and studied the songs and the songwriting and the vocal harmonies and such, I got more curious about the acts, but there was very little written about a lot of them. So over time, when the opportunity came in the late 80s, I decided someone had still not written, you know, even a relative anthology on vocal groups. I decided to take on the task. I realized when I did it why people hadn't done it before. It's a quagmire.
Yeah.
It took me 3 years to write this, the longest of all my books, to research and write. And I interviewed over 100 different acts, which took a lot of time, and I often got conflicting information. So I really had to go to the source and dispel a lot of the myths to get to the realities behind these groups, because I figured if I do this, nobody's ever going to do it after. And since nobody's done it before, I better get it right because I don't want to wind up rewriting history.
Well,
and that's pretty much how it came together. A lot of it was interviews. A lot of it was some past snippets from different old publications and things, billboards and cash boxes, magazines even put out in New York by collectors that were into this that are now rare pieces of work today that were nothing more than like 8-page sheets or something on 3 or 4 different groups once a month. But they had interviewed a lot of people as well, and they became reliable sources. And so I was just culling everything I could find. Mm-hmm. Plus, I had the advantage of having a huge record collection. As I was writing, it gave me an excuse to go and listen to a lot of my music and then to be able to, you know, bring it to fruition in terms of it having a not just a text standpoint, a historic standpoint, but also a review of a lot of the music, the beauty of a lot of the songs and recordings, emphasizing certain harmonic areas that certain groups had, from like the Four Freshmen, who the Beach Boys borrowed tremendously from, to, you know, right up through history. And so, you know, it became really a passion because I was able to, you know, extend the dryness of normal writing on a group to actually including the music and what the music was about.
Yeah. Well, it's been great fun at our house because we've given the CD player and the phonograph a workout and cleared away some furniture, and we've just been having a wonderful time telling stories and listening to music.
Well, that was the purpose of it.
Yeah. One of the stories that I love is of the Ronettes. And I think it's appropriate that we talk about the Ronettes because just a couple of days ago, on January 8th, the announcement of who will be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame this year, among the artists, the Ronettes. And this was a wonderful story that you tell about the Ronettes and how they got their start, how they were discovered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Darling Sisters, as they were originally called. I've always loved the Ronettes. I was a huge Phil Spector fan. I love the Wall of Sound. It was a whole new sound and a whole new direction in music in the early 60s, and the Ronettes were Spector's passion, so he really poured everything into their recordings. I think it was Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys who once said that Be My Baby was the most perfect rock and roll record ever made, and I think he was pretty correct in that. It's just enormous. I mean, only somebody like Ronnie Spector and her voice could have surmounted the perfect storm of Phil Spector's music and production. And yet, there were many voices on those recordings. It wasn't just the Ronettes. If you remember, I mean, Sonny Bono sang in the background on some of those records. Cher was on a lot of those records. Darlene Love and the Blossoms, who became Bobby Sox and the Blue Jeans, sang on these records. You often had 7-8 vocalists on these recordings. Also, as far as the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is concerned, I'm really glad that they got in there. But a year and a half ago, before the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame acknowledged them, I was proud to be involved in inducting them into the Vocal Group Hall of Fame at the award ceremony in Wildwood, New Jersey. This was, I think, 2005, when I co-hosted the awards with Mary Wilson of the Supremes. And we had, I think it was Nedra Talley of the group there to accept the award.
We have Be My Baby here in the studio with us, and we can play that tune. Correct me if I'm wrong now, because I've got so many things swimming around in my mind. This was their first single?
No, it wasn't their first single.
Okay.
Actually, it was, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It was their sixth single, but it was their first single with Spector.
Okay.
They had been on a label called Cold Pix, which was really Columbia Pictures, and they were just treated like a normal vocal girl group at the time, doing some innocuous recordings that are today big collector's items, but that was 61, 62. Spector found them, and in 63 he recorded Be My Baby.
And it became an international hit. And one more thing that I want to mention, because I found it such a fun thing. One of the things that happened to them is they were standing in line in front of a nightclub, and they were mistaken for a trio that had been late to show at Joey D's Peppermint Lounge in New York.
45th Street in New York, I remember it.
Yeah, very good.
They had just gone down there to see the show, and the group that was supposed to be performing was late, and so somebody saw them in their bouffant hairdos and just their look. They looked like singers.
Yeah.
So he said, "You guys are late. Come on, get inside." And so they went with him, and they wound up singing that night and got the job.
Excellent.
They were ongoing for quite a while there. As a matter of fact, part of their backup band, I believe, were members of the Rascals before they became the Rascals.
Yeah. Well, let's hear Be My Baby.
Okay.
Soda.
Ronettes, Be My Baby. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Jay Warner, music historian, music publisher, author of American Singing Groups, A History from 1940 to Today. Why were the 60s such a big decade for what were called girl groups?
Well, if I had to assess it, I would just think that things came together in such a way. There have always been trends in pop music and rock and roll. And when one thing would succeed, other companies would try to emulate it in their own style or fashion based on who they could find that could sing the style of music. When girl groups, starting mostly with, say, the Chantels and the Shirelles, started to become popular and make money for record companies, other companies decided we have to find our Shirelles and our Chantels. And so acts like the Ronettes and the Crystals and many others, started getting discovered. Also, you know, young teen girls around the country were hearing this music and decided to form groups as well. So there were just many more opportunities and many more groups taking those opportunities.
And if we go back to the 40s, because when we think of this type of music, I think the 40s, 50s, 60s, the golden age of American vocal group music. What gave rise to the interest in this music back in the 40s?
Well, a lot of it grew out of some of the big bands. There were vocalists with a lot of the bands in those days that, really started the sound as part of another sound. The Andrews Sisters, were a predominant force in those days. I would say that a lot of the big bands had groups like, the Merrimacks, the Modern Airs, the Pied Pipers, Skylarks. All of these girl groups started singing with big bands and then started to be featured on their own recordings as spin-offs. So that's really where a lot of it came from. And that developed into groups in the 50s like the Dreamers, which was later Darlene Love and her sister and a couple of other people who eventually became studio singers doing a lot of backgrounds for everybody from Elvis on down as the Blossoms. And then, as I mentioned before, they became Bobby Sox and the Blue Jeans. So there have been various mutations of groups since around the 40s. The Bobettes, for example, in the 50s, were the first female group to have a top 10 record. And they were five girls from a New York school who were probably on average age about 14, 15 years old when they had to hit Mr. Lee.
Wow.
So there was a lot of momentum for girl groups. The sound was very pleasing. It obviously excited a lot of young boys to see these young girls up performing. And if it could make money for the music business, you could be sure they would clone every act they could find to have their own Ronettes and their own Andrews.
Yeah, are you still there, Jay?
Yes, I am.
Okay, because we're having a little phone, something is a little funky with the phone there.
Oh, probably the FBI.
Oh, okay.
They can't get their system working.
Well, the heck with them.
Okay.
The Ronettes, this reminds me what you were just saying about the Ronettes, is the boys went wild. You know, we think of girls screaming at the Beatles, but apparently boys went just wild for the Ronettes.
Oh, yeah, the Ronettes had a lot of effect. And see, a lot of what I've discovered in writing the book was that there was a chronology going backwards of who influenced who. Now, the Ronettes' record, Be My Baby, was number four in England. At the time, it was number two in America, and that got the attention of the Beatles and a lot of British acts, including the Rolling Stones. And so when the Ronettes went over to England, everybody wanted to hang out with them. I mean, they were pretty girls, they sang great, and, everything American at that time was being copied in other countries, especially in Britain, and brought back to America's shores in a style now developed by those artists in those countries. And so when the Ronettes sound and the Spectre sound came out, nobody had ever heard anything like that anywhere, let alone in Britain. So the Beatles were fascinated by them, and when they came over to America, they had the Ronettes on their tour.
Wow. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Jay Warner, our guest this afternoon. Listeners, if you'd like to join us with a question or a comment, give us a phone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, thinking about those girls who were 14, 15 years old, and they were making records, they were singing on stage, performing. Did you talk to some of these folks in the course of your research? You said earlier that you had talked to, you know, over 100 people in the course of your research for this book. How did they remember this period of time in their lives?
Well, you know, everybody had different recollections. I mean, it's interesting, though, especially a lot of the 50s male groups, if you talk to them, they would tell you about every situation that they were ripped off on. How they lost money, or somebody stole this from them, or their royalties. Yeah. But I tried to not dwell on that because it became redundant. It became a fact of life that a lot of these acts either had short lives or were ripped off by various businessmen. And I tried to dwell on their creations and their place in history musically as to what they did in a positive level. But with the girls, it was more of... It ranged from situations where they didn't think that much of it until way after it happened, because sometimes the success was fleeting, or they were reveling in it tremendously, and it like with Dreamgirls, they couldn't believe they were stars, and some of them couldn't believe how fast they weren't stars anymore.
Yeah, yeah. What do you think of Dreamgirls?
I loved it. Yeah. I thought it was terrific, and I thought it was a nice portrayal of, a pseudo-supreme story with some great songs and some nice writing. I think they did a very nice job in it. I don't understand why it took 10 years, though.
Yeah. Well, one of the things preserving this history in a book like what you've done and also in a popular fictional movie is to pay tribute in a positive sense, to give these folks their due, some respect. And I think we're seeing more and more of that. And you mentioned ripoffs. There have been some bands masquerading as bands they hope to impersonate, but they are not the band. And that's been a problem as well now here today.
Yeah, it really has. But I'm pleased to say that various acts have gotten together. Members of Sha-na-na, for example, Bowser in particular, and Mary Wilson of the Supremes and various others, Tony Butella of the Letterman, have gotten together and even gone as far as going to Congress and talking to congressmen and senators about the problem. Legislation has been enacted in a number of states, and they're pushing for it in other states to where these bogus groups are being outlawed or being fined heavily for claiming to be acts that they're not. I mean, when you see 24-year-old guys out there claiming to be the Four Tops, it isn't going to happen.
Yeah.
So there is action on the scene these days, much more so than ever before, and that's hopefully helping. I mean, I know that acts like the Classics Four, the lead singer there, hadn't worked for years because bogus acts were going out as him, Dennis Yost in the Classic Four, I believe it was, and a whole bunch of others, and people were impersonating them. I remember when I was working in New York for a publisher in the 70s, and interesting quick story, the Tokens were producing various acts, and one of the acts, it wasn't even an act, he was just doing some background singing, was Tony Orlando. Tony was working as a music publisher at the time at CBS, and Tony cut a song called Knock Three Times, I believe it was, and they put it out as Dawn, and it became a huge hit, and Tony's still working at the publishing company, and there are groups going out and making believe that they're Dawn. so he got so fed up with it, he quit his job and went on the road with the actual background singers and started Tony Orlando and Dawn out of necessity because everybody was claiming to be them.
Yeah. Well, Mary Wilson was in Springfield maybe a year, 2 years ago, helped getting a law passed here in the state of Illinois to end this kind of situation.
Yeah, she's been very helpful in this area.
Yeah. We talked earlier about the inductees this year to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. The induction ceremony will include, coming up this spring, a tribute to one of its members who passed away last month, Ahmet Erdogan. Would you talk about his accomplishments, his contributions to American music? He shows up here in American Singing Groups, A History from 1940 to Today.
Well, Ahmet was incredibly unique. I mean, he was the son of the Turkish ambassador. That's not somebody you would think would become an icon in popular music, especially when popular music was not something to be associated with or proud of if you came from the family of an aristocratic ambassador. Interestingly, he just had such a love of jazz and blues that he borrowed $10,000 from his Jewish dentist and started Atlantic Records, which is an iconic label, you know, over the decades with all the acts that they've signed. One of their early acts was the Clovers. And most people don't know this, but Ahmet was not just a record enthusiast and a lover of blues and jazz and R&B, but he was an excellent songwriter. But he couldn't write music, and he couldn't read music, and what he used to do, he would write a song in his head, pretty much, and then he would go down to the little music booths on 42nd Street, the recording booths, where they had those old little paper and plastic discs that you would sing into the machine. You had about 3 minutes to sing in, or 2 minutes, and then the disc would pop out. And he would go in there and do his demos, his early demos. But because of the family situation, he didn't put his own name on the recordings. And if you look at a bunch of Clover's recordings and Ruth Brown and things like that, you'll see the name Nugetri as the writer. Well, Nugetri is Erdogan spelled backwards.
Yeah.
It was his way of doing it without upsetting his family. Yeah. Ahmet was a one-of-a-kind individual. He was a gentleman. He was a class individual. He knew music incredibly well. You couldn't fake it with him. I mean, he knew, you know, even though he couldn't read or write music, he knew if you were off pitch. He was an amazing man. In the days when entrepreneurs were doing everything from packing the records in boxes to being in the studio with them, to overseeing the mastering of the recordings, to picking the songs, to writing the songs, as in Ahmet's case, he was one of a kind. You'll never see another Ahmet Erdogan.
Yeah, I was so moved. It was not long after he had passed away that they rebroadcast an interview that he had done with Charlie Rose.
You're fading.
I'm sorry. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay. I was very touched after he passed away to see an interview that he had done with Charlie Rose rebroadcast on the Charlie Rose Show. And what a fabulous, fabulous man. Just elegant, eloquent, obviously just someone who really loved the music, and boy, he sure contributed a lot to American music.
And what's also interesting about Ahmet is that he wasn't locked in a narrow funnel, so to speak. Even though he was passionate about blues and R&B and jazz, as the label developed and grew over the years, so did Ahmet musically, in terms of expanding what the label base would be. For example, I mean, he discovered Sonny and Cher. He brought over Led Zeppelin. You know, I mean, as far afield from R&B as you can get, he
he was appreciative at that point of various types of music, and he used the Atlantic Vehicle to expose that music to the American public.
Yeah. You mentioned the Clovers. They were a very successful group, the most successful R&B group of the 50s, if I recall from your book.
Yeah.
And I have a tune from them that we can listen to here, Fool, Fool, Fool. And I don't know if you can tell us about Ahmet Ertegun and what was his contribution here on this tune?
I believe that, let's see, Fool, Fool, Fool was one of the first Atlantic releases.
Yeah.
It was probably the second release because Skylark was the first on the label. They had one other record before that. Interestingly, they did a standard version of Yes, Sir, That's My Baby. They sounded more like the Mills Brothers than they did the Clovers. But when he found them, he really raunched them up. And in 1951, he issued Fool, 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 which I believe was one of the ones he had written.
Okay, very good. Well, let's hear Fool, Fool, Fool.
Time that I met you, you looked so doggone sweet. When you walked down the street, I said, there goes my meat. That I was to fall for you. Oh, what a fool I was.
The Clovers, Fool, 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 one of the first releases from Atlantic Records. And here, you know, you can hear Ertegun, how that was a really good move to steer them to their own sound, more of an R&B sound than the sound that the Mills Brothers were famous for.
Yeah, I mean, they were doing Ink Spots type tunes and Mills Brothers, and he just took what he liked and knew that they could sing and directed them that. You notice that the song is very bass heavy and it's baritone oriented harmony, and it's a blues tune. It's
right.
Something like B.B. King could have sung.
Yeah, it's got that wonderful piano
mm-hmm.
in there as well. So that's the 1950s. When we move into the 1960s, what happens to this music, American vocal music?
Well, I mean, that's a broad statement. It went off in a lot of directions. In the 60s in particular, I would say that sounds took over in the sense of different cities had sounds. In the 60s, you had a Detroit sound, you had a Chicago sound, you had a Philly sound, you had a New York sound, especially in vocal group stylings. You could, if you were, listening even generally casually, you could listen to something and tell, that's a New York group, just based on the styling of the harmony. That's a Los Angeles group because it was a looser harmony. That's a Chicago group because it was a bluesier harmony. You could tell to a degree where the acts were from, and that was a styling. Then came the Motown sound, then came the Wall of Sound with Spectre. And so there were stylings that developed in the 60s that weren't as pronounced as they were in the 50s.
What happened to the city sounds? What happened to those distinctive stylings?
Radio. Radio really changed a lot of it when things became national radio, and people were, you know, somebody would have a hit and some other company would try to clone that style and that direction. You lost the uniqueness of an area sound because everybody was trying to have a next huge hit that sounded like the last. So you lost the interesting aspect of, you know, of stylings of a group. It's like different languages in different countries. You lost them. It would be as if all of Europe was speaking one language.
Hmm. And today, radio makes it really tough.
Oh, it's long since gone in terms of there being any kind of what we used to call regional sound. It's very difficult to hear anything that is regional. I mean, whether it's with things like hip-hop and rap in particular, I mean, it could be made in Afghanistan as well as being made in Brooklyn. There is no thread from a regional aspect in this kind of music anymore, which is sad because regional stylings developed interesting different types of music with interesting different instrumentations. It wasn't just in vocal groups. It was in a lot of different types of music. But radio would play certain types of things, so everybody was trying to get what radio would play.
Yeah.
And ever since, I would say, the late 70s, you have lost the regional aspect, and everything is just a typical a style in a very narrow cast way.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember listening to radio one day. I was out with some friends, and we just hang around, and the radio was playing in the background, and some station played about five different females in a row, and we were all music historians, and we couldn't tell one apart from the other. I mean, it was Madonna and Four Clones.
Let's take a call. A listener in Champaign would like to talk with you, Jay Warner. Good afternoon.
Yeah, actually what happened, what prompted the call was the discussion you were having about, you know, the media and radio, you know, the, what certainly doesn't help is the media consolidation. I don't know, Clear Channel has, I don't know how many thousands of stations or whatever. And what are they, in terms of play, what are they have terminology for that, that in terms of getting play on the radio, there's the cycles. You have to have so many spins or something or other. I don't know what the term is there, but they're pretty well set in that regard. And also payola certainly doesn't help, you know, especially the newcomers coming up don't have a chance to get on. So anyway, I don't know if anything you want to comment on that or not. But
well, you know, payola's been with us from the beginning. I don't think it's payola, but I think you did hit on it in that when one station or one organization like a Clear Channel can kind of pretty much own the airwaves, have a monopoly, as it were, to a great degree, it makes it that much tougher for independent music to reach the listeners because they're going to only play what they play. I mean, I'm not going to get into payola aspects, because a lot of it's speculative, and the government's doing what it does to take care of that. I mean, all five of the major record companies over the last couple of years were fined heavily by the New York Attorney General for what they were doing. But that's not a cause. That's an effect. The cause is when you monopolize anything in a music-related area, and new music, new acts can't get into the scene, you've got a real problem. And now, because of this spillover from these major labels being fined or stations, radio stations worrying about if they add a new act, they're going to be investigated, less new acts are going to be added. That only hurts music.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're missing the diversity, actually.
Yeah, and hopefully there'll be a backlash to it, to where some enterprising entity will decide to compete with a Clear Channel playing a broader base, and the public will want that.
Yeah, the other point is, I don't remember, the Atlantic, the fellow you were talking about previously.
Ahmet Erdogan.
Yeah, I also saw that program, and the same one that Celeste mentioned. And what I picked up from that, he seemed like to be very much of a human being, you know, in terms of he, from the program, stayed with the relationships. In other words, the people they promoted, you know, as friends and was concerned. So that was a real plus. So.
Yeah, very definitely. He was, you know, he was a lover of the music, so he loved the acts that created the music. There was no hypocrisy about Ahmet Erdogan. He was a true gentleman, and he enjoyed what he did. And I've never really heard anybody that that didn't like Ahmet, even people that worked very closely with him, which is, you know, where you usually hear the terrible stories. And I'm glad of that to a degree, because there's so many so-called shysters in the industry, past and present, that somebody that, you know, was good to his people, that's good to know. Of course, there's probably, you know, some things none of us know about behind the scenes, but the realities are what they are. In the public eye, he was a great man. He contributed a lot of great music that we'd never know about or be a part of, and for that you have to be thankful.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. We're at the point here, Jay, where we're going to have to wrap up. And I want to talk a little bit, before we have to go, about the 1990s and the rise, once again, of groups that sing sweet harmonies. The most popular vocal group, I think, of the decade, the 90s, was Boyz II Men. Thoughts?
I'm sorry, you cut out for a second.
I'm sorry. The 1990s, the most popular vocal group of the decade, Boyz II Men,
mm-hmm.
where we see a group coming together again and doing these harmonies that are reminiscent of a couple decades ago. They describe their music, according to you in the book, as hip hop oo-wop.
Right. Well, and rightly so. And it's nice to see an act acknowledging the past, because, as I said earlier, if you look at this in an overview, there are groups influencing groups influencing groups going back. A perfect example is if you took the group Belle Biv DeVoe, which was an outgrowth of New Edition. They were influenced by acts like the Jackson 5, who were from the 70s, who were influenced by Little Anthony and the Imperials from the 60s. And Anthony and the Imperials were influenced by the Flamingos of the 50s. And the Flamingos were influenced by the Orioles. And the Orioles were influenced by the Mills Brothers. So interestingly, you can connect the 90s group right back to the 30s in terms of influences, as to they might not exist or have a sound or have developed a sound if it hadn't been for these previous acts. And I think that's a very important link in music history overall, not just in vocal groups. The Boyz II Men group was an exceptional harmony group, but there were a lot of others, even lesser known. There are groups like the Mighty Echoes, who've had about 10 albums out. They're great doo-wop harmony enthusiasts, and they're not as well known because they weren't on a major label. Groups like All for One had one big hit and disappeared. You know, and of course, everybody can talk about NSYNC and acts like that, but those were more commercialized acts, and very frankly, they didn't sing as well.
Hmm.
You know, so I mean, you have to look at there's good and bad in every decade of every style. But you're right, Boyz II Men, they were unique in that they were both great and they were successful. Some are great and not successful, depending on their opportunities. Some are successful, and they're not that
great. There we've got to leave it. Thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon, sharing these wonderful stories. Thanks for doing the book and then updating it as well. Jay Warner,
my pleasure.
Thank you so much. We're going to go out here with Motown Philly from Boyz II Men. And let me just mention again, Jay Warner's book, American Singing Groups, A History from 1940 to Today, is published by Hal Leonard.